Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. If you pick up any basic U.S. history textbook, it will tell you that slavery in America ended with the Civil War and emancipation. This morning, however, in this part of the show, we have a story that suggests the truth is much different and much more complex. And it's a story that I expect for a lot of people will be new. In the years between the Civil War and World War II, tens of thousands of African Americans were forced to work in mines, in lumber camps, in quarries, and on farms. They'd been arrested under laws written specifically to intimidate blacks, and when they could not pay the large fines that were assessed, they were sold into forced labor. We'll explore this little-known chapter of American history this morning as we talk with Douglas Blackman. He is the Atlanta bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal and has written extensively on race, on the economy, and American society. He is the author of a book that was published earlier this spring that is titled Slavery by Another Name. The subtitle is The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. It's published by Doubleday. It's out in the bookstores now. You can find it there. I'm sure you can find it in the library if you'd like to read it. As we talk, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments and questions brief, but anyone's welcome to join the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, or maybe across the country on the Internet, you may use that toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. At any point, questions are welcome. Mr. Blackman, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
I'm happy to be with you.
Let me just to ask you to start to expand a little bit on this very brief introduction and that I made. And when you use a term like the re-enslavement of black Americans, what exactly are we talking about here?
Well, by re-enslavement, what I mean is that in the years after the Civil War, after a period in which freed slaves and their descendants experienced a period of authentic freedom and lived as citizens, lived in freedom, lived independent lives from the white people who had controlled their lives before and during the Civil War, they lived difficult, impoverished, and undereducated lives, but they lived in authentic freedom. And by re-enslavement, what I mean is that by a variety of means, primarily linked to the system you described of how laws were passed to intimidate blacks, and then thousands and thousands of African Americans were effectively sold to pay fines that were levied on them for these spurious crimes. Through that mechanism and related ones, thousands and thousands of people were forced back into labor. And many of those people were not, this wasn't simply prison labor, this wasn't simply sharecropping that was difficult. This was large numbers of people who were kidnapped off the roads of the South and sold explicitly into forced labor.
It's interesting that this subject apparently has been written about by some scholars and historians, but it's not something that has entered into the popular history, although it also seems to be the case that this is a story that African Americans know.
Well, it certainly has been my experience in talking to a lot of people about the book over the last couple of months and in the years that I worked on the book, that this is a story that African Americans, particularly an older generation of African Americans, know this story in their heart. They may not know the width and the breadth of what happened. They may not know exactly how their own family stories, which dovetail with these events, they may not completely know the degree to which those episodes were in fact one among thousands or hundreds of thousands of nearly identical incidents. But African Americans do know this story in their heart, but it has been difficult to establish in a kind of empirical way, in an irrefutable way, that in fact across the South there was a de facto system of slavery, what I call neo-slavery, which controlled or dramatically influenced and circumscribed the lives of millions of African Americans. But it is something, you mentioned that scholars have written some about this in the past, that is true. There has, though, been a reluctance among many historians to, in my view, to confront the degree to which that the old system of leasing prisoners by states and by county governments was not just an abusive penal system. It was, in fact, a labor system, and it was explicitly designed to create a way of taking innocent individuals, because the vast majority of these people had not committed crimes, had not done anything other than an offense against the racial code of the day and the social behaviors that were expected of blacks. The vast majority of them had committed no meaningful crime. And so this really wasn't about punishing lawbreakers. It was about forcing armies of black men back into coerced labor for an economic system that could not operate without slavery.
And this, I think this is a really important point and something that you deal with early in the book, and that is what the end of the, what the effects of the war and the end of the slavery meant for the economy of the South. They needed workers. The economy before had rested on the work of slaves, and now they needed people to work. They also, that is, many white Southerners were also concerned about now they had a lot of free African Americans that were largely beyond their control. So for them, this instituting this kind of system did a couple of things. It provided cheap labor, essentially free labor, and it also was a way to control the lives of black Americans living in the South.
It was a way of terrifying huge numbers of African Americans, and it was one of the principal means of intimidating African Americans away from participating in the political process and away from actually seizing upon and making full use of their new rights as fully fledged American citizens. It was absolutely a mechanism for terrorizing, but that was a side effect. It became a major element of what was happening, but initially it was a side effect. What it really was about, as you describe in the beginning, was that the South, the white South, particularly the large landowning farming classes of the South, were paralyzed after the Civil War. They were helpless without forced labor, and there's really no overstating that, because the practices of farming, which were used all through the South, relied completely on labor practices that counted on the availability of large gangs of young black men who would work in a particular way and using particular techniques under the supervision of overseers, some of whom were white, some of whom were black. But without that labor system, white landowners simply could not comprehend how to grow cotton without forced laborers. And so that began to create a very strong economic incentive and motivation for whites to find new mechanisms for enslaving African Americans. And then that also coincided with, and it also became a necessity, and you couldn't reinstitute slavery if blacks were voting and selecting lots of political candidates. It would make it almost impossible to pass laws that would recreate some form of slavery. And so all of these things began to work closely together to end the freedom of millions of black Americans and put the economy, the agricultural economy, back on its feet using forced labor.
Yeah. One other quick point, and then we'll start to work some callers in here. And it may not have been a direct intention here, but also another effect was that it really was a, and I think you actually used the terms, it was used as a weapon against people who were trying to organize workers in the South. It was a weapon used against unionization.
Absolutely. There were, in fact, some of the, both against unionization and against political activity by African Americans. It was no coincidence that that when in Greene County, Alabama, in the 1880s, when two African American men began to emerge as influential and fairly powerful political leaders, that within a very short period of time they found themselves arrested on completely spurious charges and sold into a coal mine on the outskirts of Birmingham, where they were never heard from again.
We have a couple of callers here. Let me we'll get to them just as soon as I introduce again our guest, Douglas Blackman. He's the Atlanta Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal, and he is the author of the book Slavery by Another Name. The subtitle is The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. It's published by Doubleday, came out in March. You can certainly find the book, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our first caller is in Indiana. So we'll go to the toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm glad I turned you on this morning. This is something my high school and certain colleagues failed to tell me about. And most of my black friends undoubtedly didn't know about it either, because it never became an issue on campus when they were trying to retrieve some history. I first thought about indentured servants when you talked about what you were talking about. But I guess what I'm after is the data. For example, I thought about the unionization, and you've already answered that question. I was wondering if there were any lawyers who showed up, tried to take on those cases to help out the black community at that time. And secondly, I wonder if there's actual written statements down, or however they would be taken in their meetings at the state legislatures and stuff like that, where it was more or less, you know, everybody's talking freely about what they were really doing. And do we have any of that in black and white? And I'll hop off. Another nice show, David.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, great questions. The in terms of the record, and I'd encourage you to read the book, and also I'd encourage all your listeners, David, to check out the website, which is Slavery by Another Name, all one word, .com. There are a lot of images and some original documents that I've scanned onto the website, including death registries of hundreds and hundreds of African Americans who died in these slave mines on the outskirts of Birmingham in the late 1800s and early 1900s. But the part of what is so astonishing about all of this, and was astonishing to me as I researched it, is that the conventional history of this period of time is mostly reliant on what's in the state archives of the southern states. That's where most historians go. They go to the state capital of Montgomery, Alabama, or one of the other state capitals, and spend weeks and weeks going through the official archive of the state government. Well, that's essentially a 19th, early 20th century white man's version of what was happening. And, of course, whites and those in power at that time were surprisingly transparent about what they were doing, and so there are reams and reams and reams of discussion and testimony and transcripts of discussions in the state legislatures and commissions that went on, in which the intention of these laws was very explicit. It was absolutely transparent what was happening, and there were some people who were opposed to it at the time too. You have to give some credit to that, though very few in reality. And in terms of lawyers, the legal system completely abrogated its duties to African Americans. There were some blacks who were able to have legal representation in court proceedings, but it was extraordinarily rare, and there were very few cases in which a person who had been unjustly convicted of one of these made-up laws. And the laws, by the way, were things like that there would be people imprisoned for vagrancy. Thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands, really, of people were imprisoned for vagrancy, which was simply the inability of a person to prove at any given moment that they did not have a job. And of course, in an era in which there were no pay slips, it was impossible for any person to prove they had a job, any poor person, a farm laborer, to prove they had a job, other than by having a landowner, inevitably a white man, step forward and vouch for them. And so if you were a young black man in the South in 1905, or like the main character of my book, Green Cottenham, a young man like Green Cottenham, if he did not have a white man who would step forward and say, "This is a Negro that I control," if there was not a white man who was willing to step forward and say such a thing, it was virtually impossible for him to avoid any possibility of being arrested and charged and convicted of vagrancy. But the other offenses that were used were things like talking loudly in the presence of white women, any sort of sexual relations between blacks and whites. There were thousands and thousands of African-American men who were imprisoned for breaking a law which made it illegal for a farm laborer to change employers. to leave the farm of one man and go to another farmer without permission from the first farmer. So effectively, a black man in the South could not leave the farm where he was working without the permission of the white man, just as it had been in slavery. And so there were hundreds of these various laws which effectively criminalized black life, and African Americans rarely ever had the benefit of lawyers to defend them in those cases. And then the other thing you ask about was the data, and also speaking to the records. In that case, one of the things I did that was different from what any conventional historians had done in the past was that I went out into the county courthouses of counties all across Alabama and Georgia and Florida in particular. And what I discovered was that in the basements and in storage buildings and all kinds of abandoned places all over the South, there are in fact thousands and thousands and thousands of volumes of the original arrest records of this period of time. And by working through those and studying what actually happened in places over the course of many, many years, it becomes absolutely evident that what was going on was not law enforcement and the penalizing of true criminals. This was a system that was designed to seize African Americans and provide them to economic and commercial parties who needed large gangs of black labor, and to do it in the most timely and efficient economic way for those businesses. It was not about lawbreakers. It was a labor system.
And just to be clear about the laws that we're talking about, for example, the kind of law that you cited that says if you're working on a farm, you couldn't just pick up and leave and go to the next farm to work there without the permission of the first farmer that you were working for. And that and some of the other kinds of laws that we're talking about, were they specifically written only to apply to African Americans?
They didn't say this law will only be enforced against African Americans, but in the vast majority of instances, they only ever were enforced against African Americans. African-Americans. And that was the intention. That was the doublespeak of American life at that time, just like the whole concept of separate but equal that, you know, we've all heard about, and that was, you know, that legal concept was created in 1896 through a Supreme Court ruling that ratified that you could have segregated schools and segregated transportation and segregated restaurants. That was ruled to be legal as long as the separate services were identical and were equal to one another. And, of course, they weren't equal anywhere. You know, nowhere in America, whether in the North or the South, did African Americans receive equal service to what white Americans did. And yet all of America, for 50 years, was able to convince itself through this sort of doublespeak of the time that, in fact, there was equality between these obviously disparate services. And so these laws that I'm talking about in the South were very similar in that they were racially neutral on their face and in the words, but then they were overwhelmingly applied only to African Americans. That is not to say that there were not a small number of whites who were sucked into this system in various ways, but overwhelmingly, and by that I mean in excess of 90% almost all of the time, these were laws that were enforced only against African Americans, and the most brutal, and by the way, the working conditions that these men were forced into resembled a German death camp more than they did a private prison of today or even a difficult farm. These were horrifying places of tremendous physical abuse, incredible mortality, malnutrition, just unspeakably terrible circumstances in hundreds of places across the South. And those conditions, those terrible lives, were reserved overwhelmingly for blacks only.
Let's talk with someone here where we are in Urbana. This is line one.
Hello.
Hello. Yes?
I was wondering if there were this applied to women and children at all, and to what extent the men were removed totally from their home life, and were there any, I mean, there was an awful lot of people involved in emancipation. What happened to these people regarding this situation?
Well, these definitely were men who were removed from their lives to the great detriment, obviously, of their families and their communities. I mean, this is one of the most explicit reasons why it took, you know, why there was so little economic progress made by African Americans in the South between the Civil War and the 1950s. And one of those reasons was because so many African American families were devastated by the seizure of the the father of the family and his being forced into an economic system from which he would never have any economic benefit because he was functioning as a slave. But these men were, once they were arrested, once they were sold into this de facto slavery, they ended up in forced labor camps. There were dozens of forced labor camps all over states like Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, northern Florida, parts of the Carolinas, and these would be work camps where a group of 100 to 200 men would be housed in tents or in these sort of rolling cages. They looked like railroad cars, but that were cages and that were on wheels and were pulled by horses from one place to another. They would do road work. They would do lumbering operations. There were also, in places where there was mining in the South, in particular, in Alabama, northern Georgia, a few other places, you had slave mines in which a stockade surrounded the area where the openings to the mine were, and the men who were there lived in barracks and oftentimes moved through tunnels that led from their barracks directly into the mines, and they worked beginning before daylight and into the night every day, so they would go months at a time without ever seeing sunlight in some of these places where they worked 7 days a week. These were definitely men removed from their communities and their families and held in these terribly oppressive circumstances. There were many children. There were huge numbers of children, though overwhelmingly boys, teenage boys. It was extremely common to find a large number of 13 or 14 or 15-year-old black boys who would be in the rosters of these camps, also charged under the most flimsy, spurious sorts of offenses. There's a photograph on the website of a group of about 35 or 45 juvenile boys working in a sugarcane field from sometime late in the 19th century. And there were some women who were drawn into the system, too. But this was another proof of how this was a labor system, not a law enforcement system, because only the number of women who were necessary for what were viewed as women's roles at the time, cleaning and cooking and washing, very, very limited amount of work that was viewed in all of this as something that a woman was capable of. But there would be a certain number of women forced into the system, but only enough to fill those specific labor needs.
All right. I appreciate the caller. Let's go on. We'll talk with someone next in Effingham. This is line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. Thank you, David, for a great program. The history of what is being discussed here takes me back to Western Europe and the use of women and children in mines there, where they passed along a bowl, a wooden bowl with the coal in it, up out of the mine and onto the top of the ground, that sort of thing, which was not chattel slavery, because I think chattel slavery was a step above wage slavery, which is what we have in these times, and all the different levels of that. I don't think a whole lot has changed under the capitalist system that can be beneficial for anyone except an elite group who are riding at the middle or on top of the system. The last thing I'd like to say is that my experience on Interstate 70 and in the state of Illinois, striped suits for people in jail before trial, some of them even taken. I think of Warren Jeffs in Texas when he went before the courts there in a striped suit, and here on Interstate 70 and other interstates, orange jumpsuits, convict labor cleaning up, and prison industry is still alive and well. I'll ring off and listen on. Thanks again.
Right. I think your caller is right that there continues to be convict labor in use, and you certainly in the South, in various places, it's not uncommon to see, and I think all over the country, it's not uncommon to see county prisoners out picking up litter by the side of the roadway or doing other kinds of work. And there certainly are industries that that now specialize in making use of prison labor. And all of that is related in some respects back to the things I write about in the book. In terms of penal history, the tradition of requiring prisoners to work is a long one and that continues today. And in fact, the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, has only one exception, and that is for that involuntary servitude is permitted for individuals duly convicted of a crime. But duly is the key word, and one of the key distinctions between what I write about historically and the debate over what is happening today. Clearly, there are serious issues about the penal system and the law enforcement system and the judicial process of today just by virtue of the percentage of African-American men who are incarcerated being so high. Just in and of itself, it seems to raise a question about sociological, if not legal, issues that are very serious. But in terms of what I write about in Slavery by Another Name and in stories of men like Jonathan Davis, who was a white farmer who in September of 1901 left his field at the peak of harvest to try to get to the home of his parents-in-law, where his wife, Nora, was dying, and he's trying to reach her before she dies, and their two children are there with her, and on his way to try to reach his dying wife, he's confronted in the road by a white constable, kidnapped, thrown into a jail, and sold the next day along with three other men to a notoriously brutal white farmer who, over the span of about a year and a half in that period of time, I was able to establish had purchased at least 80 kidnapped men who he held in a whole variety of different operations on his farm. These were not men who had broken laws. These were not men who had, one could even make a shimmer of an argument that they were criminals. They had never been duly convicted, and these were men, women, and young children who were being held as slaves on this farm, and they were bought and sold. There were markets for these people. There were men who came to specialize in the beginning of the 20th century of traveling from, you know, from one town to the next and buying and selling black people. I mean, this was happening in the early part of the 20th century, and these were not people who had committed crimes or been duly convicted of crimes. And so in that respect, the phenomenons that I talk about in Slavery by Another Name are different and in some regards much more horrifying than anything that's happening today.
Just would some of the people that were using these workers, would they have claimed that they were in fact paying wages? And if that was the case, then where did that money go?
They would claim, they never claimed they were paying wages, but they would claim that in fact these were people who had committed crimes.
Yeah.
And that a warrant had been signed out, claiming one of these spurious offenses against someone, and that they had paid that person's fine, and that the person had then agreed to work for them to pay back the money for the fine. Almost always, those were sham, just complete shams. And part of which was that the great majority of the people who were drawn into the system were illiterate, and so even if there were a piece of paper that ostensibly was a contract in which they had agreed to work for someone for 1 or 2 or 3 years, they wouldn't have been able to read it, and it happened very commonly that someone would be seized and forced into one of these arrangements. And there would be a contract that allegedly they'd agreed to, where they would work for 1 or 2 years. But then, at the expiration of that period of time, the landowner would simply say, "Oh, those overalls you're wearing are ones you actually stole from me, and so I'm swearing out a warrant against you for petty theft. You can either have something really terrible happen to you, or you can agree that you committed petty theft." And sign another contract and stay with me for another 2 years or 3 years. If people did not die under these circumstances, they were usually able to get out of this cycle at some point in time, most often simply because they got sick or they grew older, and the landowner simply didn't want them anymore because it was easier and better to seize a younger, stronger black farm worker and make them do the work. And so finally people would escape from these circumstances. But in one case in the book, I talk about two young boys, Luke and Henry Tinsley, who I was able to find them on one of these slave farms Both of them younger than the age of 10 at the time that I was first able to establish they had been drawn into this slavery system. And one of them, I relocated him in 1930, still working as a prison laborer in Alabama. And there were periods of time, and I first found him in 1895, and he's under the age of 10. And then I find him again in 1930, still a part of the prison labor system in Alabama. And so there were instances like this where people effectively spent the great majority of their lives as slaves through these mechanisms.
Yeah. Our guest is Douglas Blackman. He is the author of the book Slavery by Another Name. The subtitle is The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. It is published by Doubleday. Our guest is the Atlanta Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal. Questions are welcome. We're past our midpoint here, and we have several waiting, and we'll get right to them, starting with Champaign County and line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
How did the abolitionists in the North react to this re-enslavement?
That's a great question. The with a tragic answer, to be honest. The reality was that in the first years after the Civil War, when the South, by various means, attempted to undo the effect of emancipation, in the beginning, Northern whites were very vigilant in their protection of the freed slaves. I mean, that's one reason why federal troops remained garrisoned in the South for more than a decade after the Civil War. And so during that period of time, during the Reconstruction era, when there were efforts by whites to prevent blacks from voting or exercising other civil rights, there was a military force there to prevent that from going any further than it did. And there were many times that laws were passed, particularly right after the Civil War, by the Southern states, which in fact explicitly tried to recreate slavery, and those were nullified by the Union generals who were in command of various sections of the South in that period of time. But by the time we get to the 1880s and Reconstruction is over, there's still a debate going on in the North about the progressive stripping away of civil rights of African Americans. There's a lot of concern being expressed about that in places like Illinois and in the Northeast. There are even Northern members of Congress who continue to reintroduce legislation in every session of the U.S. Congress proposing that federal troops be reinserted in the South to protect the civil rights of blacks. That debate continues right up into the early 1890s. But as of 1892, it stops. The 1892 is the last year in which there is such a debate about sending troops back to the South that occurs in the Congress. And by the time you get to 1900, essentially white America, and by that I mean whites in all regions of the country, were simply exhausted by the whole question of how can freed slaves and their descendants be integrated into mainstream American life. And it was something that by that time it had occupied, it had been the primary question facing America for 35 years. It seemed intractably difficult, and of course it is difficult. I mean, it's what we're seeing in Iraq today is a demonstration of how difficult it is, even after you've militarily defeated a society, how incredibly difficult it is to impose a different moral, ethical set of sensibilities upon a different country. And that's what America was wrestling with itself. It simply had not been able to make the Southern society evolve in a way that would allow for African Americans to be integrated into society. And on top of that, as some African Americans, it was still very few really, but as some African Americans began to migrate to the North, and this became an issue that Northerners also had to confront in a direct way, it was much more difficult for whites to deal with on a face-to-face basis rather than as something that was happening far away in the South. So the end result of all that was that by 1900, white Americans, even many of the people who had been the most progressive defenders of blacks, had essentially given up on the whole effort to bring full citizenship to African Americans. And it was at that point, after Northern whites abandoned blacks in the South, it was then that the white South that this venal, malevolent form of violence and the worst forms of this of neo-slavery metastasized and became far more extreme and far more expansive across the South.
All right, let's talk again. Next caller is in Champaign. This would be line number two. Hello.
Thank you, and I want to thank you for writing this book and illuminating this hidden part of history. Actually, a previous caller, while I was waiting to get on, brought this subject up, but I'd expand on it a little bit, the parallels with the current prison system. The private prison industry is actually very actively lobbying to increase sentencing lengths and criminalize, you know, activities that maybe wouldn't imprison people before. I mean, they're really trying to get more business, so to speak, and they've even, you know, worked to get their people into judgeships that can funnel more people into their prisons and you know, compete for jobs and that sort of thing. So, you know, I think there's some dangerous parallels that are, you know, developing today with all this, and maybe, you know, this work that you're doing will help, you know, even get people to be aware of that.
Well, I would certainly agree with you that, and I, you know, ironically enough, I sort of know more about prison labor in 1910 than I do in 2008. And so exactly what's happening on the ground today, I don't know the details of, but I will tell you, if it is the case that that the incarceration system begins to be something that is motivated primarily by economic incentives, where profit-making on the part, particularly if the profit-making involves law enforcement, because that's one of the things my book deals with very extensively, is that the people who were making the most money off this system were both the companies that relied on forced labor, but also the law enforcement officers themselves, who received most of their compensation based on how many people they arrested and then could lease into these de facto slave operations. And if the present-day legal system begins to reach a place where police officers and their commanders are primarily motivated in terms of compensation to arrest as many people as possible for that reason, then I would agree that is a very dangerous thing, as proven by what's in my book.
All right. Again, I want to thank the caller. We just have about 10 minutes left. We have some other callers, and I have somebody here on a cell phone, so I want to get to them. Line 3. Hello.
Are you having me now?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. And again, thank you for a wonderful program and helping. I help prepare middle-level social studies teachers, and this is such wonderful information. Let's hope it finds its way into the school textbooks. You know, helping the malnourished information that's in there right now.
By the way, the paperback comes out in February of 2009, so I hope that will make it even more accessible to students and teachers.
It will. Thank you. Two quick questions. One, did you find any evidence of these de facto re-enslavement institutions or opportunities happening in any of the northern states? And second, did we know that many free blacks participated in newly formed state legislatures during Reconstruction. Did they, by the 1880s, play any role in trying to affect change against these practices in the southern states?
There were certainly African-Americans who resisted this, African-American leaders who did, but it's important to remember that as of 1901, there essentially were no blacks voting anywhere in the South. I mean, there were a very few places in the South where African Americans could still participate politically, but they were extremely rare and very far apart, and there was no meaningful black participation in the political process by 1901. And so up until 1901, to the degree that blacks were involved in the political process, there was strong opposition to these kinds of practices, and there were some whites who were opposed as well. There was a U.S. attorney in Montgomery, Alabama, in 1903, who attempted to bring to prosecute some people for efforts to enslave blacks. All of those prosecutions, for the most part, failed. in the few cases in which anyone was convicted or pleaded guilty to crimes, they ultimately were pardoned by Teddy Roosevelt as president. Booker T. Washington, who at the beginning of the Roosevelt presidency was a great ally of the White House, Booker T. Washington was a forceful voice against all of this, but he did it very quietly and only in his private, for the most part, in his private correspondence with President Roosevelt and others. And so there was a percolating resistance out there, and certainly on an individual level, thousands of African Americans resisted all of this in ways that were very personal in terms of and internal in terms of, you know, preserving their own identities and their sense of independence, even in this terrorist regime that really had come to dominate their lives. But in terms of active political force and participation and protest, there was not much of that on the surface coming from African Americans because the jeopardy of doing that was so great.
All right. Again, someone here in Champaign County for another caller, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering if you're talking to people about compensation. I mean, there a lot of people lampoon the idea of reparations, but this is pretty clear that there's a paper trail, at least in some of these instances, and that I think it's arguable that, you know, for the more traditional form of wanting reparations as a cultural unit or something, but this goes up, as you say, until World War II. So it seems to me that are you talking to anybody in these?
Well, terms? that's a great. I mean, a lot of people make an observation like that and ask me questions about that. In the epilogue of the book, I specifically say that the book is not a call for financial reparations. But it's also not in opposition to reparations. It certainly is the case, as you point out, that the events in Slavery by Another Name and the age of neo-slavery, as I call it, these are events which extended into the lives of many people who are alive today. And these are things which affected the lives of our grandparents or our great-grandparents, in some cases even our parents. And so these forms of abuse tell us much more and explain much more about why the black-white divide in America is as it is today. It's much more related to these events, in my view, than it is to antebellum slavery. And, as you point out, it's much easier, much more obvious, the specific connections between the economic condition of a family alive today, and the person or the company that most benefited from the enslavement of their grandparent or great-grandparent in the 20th century. And so if one were looking for opportunities to draw those, you know, to put together that formula, this is a much more straightforward circumstance to do that in than antebellum slavery, which is the kind of slavery reparations that people have heard the most about. But in the epilogue of the book, the epilogue is a series of dialogues between me and various people who connect back to these events, including several of the companies that still survive today, including U.S. Steel Corp., which I think a lot of Illinois listeners have some familiarity with. In fact, Judge Gary, after whom Gary is named, the city, is a character in the book, and U.S. Steel was a great beneficiary of this system with coal mines that it owned in Alabama in the early part of the 20th century.
So he wasn't providing enforced labor for the plants up along the Mission Lake?
No, and I think one of your callers asked, and I did not answer, about whether this sort of thing happened in the North. It really did not. There was prison labor in the North. There's certainly no doubt that that happened, and there were, you know, factories inside prisons, but nothing like what I'm talking about. This incredibly abusive, incredibly high mortality a system of kidnapping and selling people, that was something that was endemic to the South, but limited to the South.
Well, I hope people take your work on and bring it to this contemporary resolution. Thanks.
All right, thank you. We have just about 5 minutes left. One question I want to make sure that I have you talk about here is how it is that this came to end, because it did eventually, although here we're talking about something that lasted from the, say, the late 1800s up until the eve of World War II. What is it that finally brought this system to an end?
Well, one of the most astonishing things that I learned in the course of researching the book was that while slavery was made unconstitutional as of 1865 by the 13th Amendment, Congress never actually passed a law making it a crime to hold slaves. And so you had this paradoxical legal limbo in which slavery was unconstitutional, but an act of enslavement was not a crime. And so in the first years after the Civil War, though, everyone assumed that it was a crime, and the federal troops in the South would arrest someone if they were still trying to hold the slaves they had owned before the Civil War. But over time, that began to fade, and as these new forms of coerced labor that were de facto the same as the old slavery but operating somewhat differently, as those began to be to become commonplace, people began to realize that there actually was no law against slavery. And so that legal limbo continued all the way up past the end of World War II. And it became the policy of the Department of Justice that since there was no federal law making it a crime to hold a slave, the U.S. attorneys around the South, generally speaking, would not investigate or prosecute cases of slavery because there was no federal law on which they could act. Finally, that changed when, shortly after Pearl Harbor in 1941, President Roosevelt called together his cabinet and had a meeting to discuss what the most urgent issues facing the war mobilization were going to be, and very quickly the topic came up of how the Japanese presumably would use the mistreatment of blacks in the South as a propaganda weapon against the United States during the war. And that started a series of conversations at the Department of Justice about laws which should be introduced in Congress to remedy this. And so an anti-lynching law was written, but then the Attorney General was told about this strange legal limbo around slavery, and that, in fact, there were many places in the South where slaves were still being held. In fact, there are more than 30,000 pages of material in the National Archives that relate to complaints of slavery that were made to the federal government, the great majority of which were never seriously investigated or prosecuted during that period of time. But as a result of those conversations, the Attorney General ordered that slavery cases be investigated and prosecuted, and a legal strategy was developed for how to do that, even with no law against slavery. And in 1942, a man and his adult daughter near Corpus Christi, Texas, were arrested for having held a black man as a slave for at least 5 years and having abused him horribly during that period of time. And they were tried and convicted in 1942 and sent to prison in 1943. And that's what I mark as the technical end of the age of neo-slavery.
Hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about the value of slave labor to the economy of the South in the period before the Civil War, and the fact that after emancipation that Southerners really needed to do something to recapture that labor, particularly for agriculture. Is there any way to put a number on the value in terms of dollars of the labor of the people that were part of the system that we're talking about?
I don't know a way to do that. It certainly would be billions and billions of dollars. It would be a vast sum. And that also speaks to what ultimately what made this system come to an end was not just the technical change in the legal methodology of the federal government in the 1940s. What really brought all this to an end was the same thing that started it, and that was the economy of the South changed. And so the necessity of these armies of black men as laborers through the 19th and early 20th century began to diminish as the farming economy of the South changed, the introduction of tractors and cotton pickers and the development of herbicides that would kill weeds rather than having to have hundreds of men using a hoe to dig out weeds in the field. And so the need for black forced labor began to diminish as well, somewhat simultaneous to the period of World War II, And so that began to break up the system in its own way. And then finally what happened was that large numbers of black men came back from World War II simply unwilling to return to the state of servitude that they had been held in before the war, and insistent that that the freedoms that America had fought for in other countries, that it was time that they be applied in America as well. And really that's the beginning of the civil rights movement.
Yeah. And a lot of these people were working in agriculture, in addition to that, there were other kinds of work that ultimately meant that they were working for large corporations?
Absolutely. And U.S. Steel Corp. is the most identifiable of those. But almost all of the major American railroads of today are descendant companies from companies that relied on this form of labor to build thousands and thousands of miles of railroad track all across the South. There are lumber companies in the country today that reach back to the companies that were employing thousands of forced laborers to harvest timber and to harvest turpentine, which was a huge industry at the beginning of the 20th century. And in mining, and both coal mining and steel making, iron and steel making, there was this huge reliance by the companies that were operating in Alabama and Tennessee, and many of those companies connect to corporations which are still around today. And on top of that, there were great family fortunes that were assembled on the basis of this form of labor, which then flowed into the creation of many iconic companies. Some of the biggest public utilities and other companies relate back to this, as do consumer products companies like Coca-Cola, where there's no direct connection between the company and these events, but the people who created the modern Coca-Cola company in 1919 were wealthy capitalists who had made their fortunes through this form of forced labor.
If you want to read more on the subject, look for the book Slavery by Another Name, The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. It's been out now for a couple of months, published by Doubleday. The author, our guest, Douglas Blackman. He is the Atlanta Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Blackman, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a great conversation.